Sundays. Oh, Lord. In July in Georgia, where the sun was hot as a blaze, my folk was sharecropper at the end of the year. So depressed. Oh, Lord, I need some rest. I hitchhiked to New York City, Chicago, Cleveland, and Detroit, singing loud and strong. Everywhere I went along, everything I do is wrong. Somebody, I'm so depressed. I want somebody to call my own, not just a roof over my head, but a place that is a home. Just kiss and squeeze me tight, squeeze me, baby, squeeze me all night. Hold me, baby, till I feel all right.
Depression by Abner J. Miriam Bradley with her version of Green Rocky Road right before that. And that little segment just had to fit in a little bit more Angel and Heavy Syrup from their third album. Thanks for listening to An Experiment with Time here on WRCT Pittsburgh. We're going to close out the experiment with Florence Aduny from her 2021 single, Naba Aferda. Have a great night, folks.
court is going to be hearing arguments on the unprecedented Colorado ruling disqualifying Donald Trump from that state's 2024 Republican primary ballot. Legal experts say that there are several ways that the justices could actually reverse that decision without weighing in directly on Trump's conduct or allegations that he engaged in that deadly insurrection after the 2020 election. Our senior correspondent, Devin Dwyer, joining us now to talk about this. So what can we expect from the proceedings tomorrow? And do you actually think Trump may show up? You really never know what he's going to do. I probably shouldn't have even asked you that.
Well, you don't. They're not expecting him to come, but as we've seen, anything can happen.
It would make a spectacle, wouldn't it?
Sure it sure would make the headlines. With three justices that he appointed on that court deciding this huge case, Kira, this is a really big deal tomorrow at the Supreme Court. For a court that likes to stay away from politics, the court is now stepping into the middle of the 2024 presidential election. They're taking on this question that's divided states, it's divided election officials, it's divided the country. Everybody has an opinion. Is Donald Trump ineligible to be on the ballot because of his efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election? Colorado's top court said last year he's ineligible. He's disqualified because he engaged, in their words, in insurrection. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says anyone who took an oath to defend the Constitution as an officer of the United States and then engaged in insurrection can't hold office ever again. That's what that court found. And tomorrow the justices are going to hear Trump's appeal. He says Section 3 does not apply to him. He says he didn't engage in insurrection. And we'll see what the justices have to say about that. They're not expected to rule from the bench, but their questions, as you know, could give us a hint of which way they're going to go.
Do you have any idea when we could have a decision?
Well, the decision is going to come relatively quickly for the Supreme Court. The expectation is a number of weeks, certainly not in June. Colorado's primary is on Super Tuesday, March 5th. So the expectation is that they will issue some sort of a decision so that voters can go to the polls in Colorado knowing, you know, the standing of an outcome of this case. So we're thinking in a couple of weeks. It won't happen tomorrow, though.
And then there's all the lawsuits that are out there.
Oh, my goodness. there are so many lawsuits on this issue alone, dividing the states. And this decision in this case will be historic. Never before has the Supreme Court taken up this question of the 14th Amendment. It's 150 years old, Kira. It was enacted after the Civil War. So tomorrow is going to be fascinating. Attorneys on both sides of the case expect the justices to take this extremely seriously, engage with the questions, engage with the issue. We'll have to see whether they get into the nitty-gritty about whether they think Donald Trump is an insurrectionist. There are lots of different ways that they could decide this case, including some that are technical, procedural. But no doubt those questions from those justices are going to be absolutely fascinating and historic. And the decision they render will be a landmark.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, U.S. corporate media's story about Haiti is familiar. Haiti, according to various recent reports, has whipped from one calamity to another. The country is a cataclysm of hunger and terror, teetering on the brink of collapse, spiraling deeper into chaos, or else descending into gang-fueled anarchistic chaos. It's become a dangerously rudderless country. According to one Florida paper's editorial, Haiti's unrest is now becoming our problem as, quote, Floridians and the U.S. struggle to help people in Haiti, although history suggests there are no answers, close quote. Or, well, there is one answer. The Washington Post made space for a former ambassador to explain that 20 years ago in Haiti, quote, the worst outcomes were avoided through decisive American intervention. Today's crisis might require it as well, close quote. At this point, the Austin American Statesman's Haiti cannibalism claims unfounded might pass for refreshing. AP had a piece that actually talked to Haitians amid what is indeed a deep and deepening crisis. A grandmother told the wire service, We're living day by day and hoping that something will change. We will talk about what has to change, including, importantly, Western media presentations that ignore or erase even recent history, with Chris Bernadelle from the Black Alliance for Peace, Haiti America's team, and Haitian grassroots group Molagaf. But first, a quick look back at some recent press. Elon Musk, the right-wing anti-union billionaire owner of Twitter, recently rebranded as X, has cast himself as a free speech crusader against censorship in Brazil. Such framing is, unsurprisingly, BS. It's instead a political crusade by a capitalist to use social media to reshape global politics in favor of the right. And as Ari Paul writes for Fair.org, it's important that we all understand why that is. So, as Reuters reported, Brazilian Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes ordered the blocking of certain accounts on Twitter, which led Musk to announce that Twitter would defy the judge's orders because they were unconstitutional, and to call for Moraes' resignation. It's not clear which accounts are being targeted, but the judge is investigating digital militias that have been accused of spreading fake news and hate messages during Bolsonaro's term, as well as probing an alleged coup attempt by Bolsonaro. The AP reported that the judge opened up an inquest into Musk directly, saying that the media mogul, quote, began waging a public disinformation campaign regarding the top court's actions, close quote. Musk says that his valiant, self-sacrificing effort is in the name of free speech, telling the Wall Street Journal, quote, we will probably lose all revenue in Brazil and have to shut down our office there, close quote. But, quote, principles matter more than profit, close quote. For those not already gagging, remember that Musk's Twitter has been eager to censor content at the request of the Indian government, including a BBC documentary that was critical of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. India under Modi has seen a steep decline in press freedom, troubling journalists around the world. But out of the same mouth used to pretend to defend free speech in Brazil, Musk was bragging about traveling to India to meet with Modi. Musk censored Twitter content in the Turkish election in response to a request from Turkish President Recep Erdogan, saying, quote, the choice is to have Twitter throttled in its entirety or limit access to some tweets. Which one do you want? Close quote. Turkey is almost synonymous at this point with speech suppression. It ranks 165 out of 180 on Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index. But Musk didn't seem to feel the need to intervene to save democracy there. The impact of Musk's decision to censor Twitter when it comes to Turkey and India isn't just that it exposes his duplicity when it comes to free speech. It robs the global public of vital points of view when it comes to those countries. In essence, the crime isn't so much that Musk is hypocritical, but that his administration of the social media site has kept readers in the dark rather than expanding their worldview. The context in Brazil is that in the last presidential election in 2022, leftist challenger Lula da Silva ousted Bolsonaro, who has since been implicated in a failed coup attempt resembling the January 6, 2021 riot here. The Washington Post reported that social media in Brazil were, quote, flooded with disinformation, along with calls in Portuguese to stop the steal, close quote, and also demands for a military coup in response to a possible Lula victory. Since then, tech companies have bristled at Brazil's attempt to curb the influence of fake news, including a bill that would put the onus on the internet companies, search engines, and social messaging services to find and report illegal material. And while those problems extend to various online media, a source told the Washington Post that they coincided with Musk firing people in Brazil who moderated content on the platform to catch posts that broke its rules against incitement to violence and misinformation. Lula's victory was a source for hope for Brazil's poor and working class and a blow to the kind of right-wing despotism espoused by people like Bolsonaro, who represents a past of U.S.-aligned terror states that use military force to protect U.S. interests and suppress egalitarian movements. That's why Brazilian Report, for example, says that Musk is joining a campaign led by the Brazilian far right. And it's why the Wall Street Journal writes that, quote, supporters of right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro, who gave Musk a medal during his visit in 2022 to announce plans to install satellites over the Amazon rainforest, have reveled in Musk's defiance, declaring him a hero as the dividing lines in Brazil's culture wars deepen, close quote. So Elon Musk isn't just being a high-profile hypocrite when he pretends to fight for free speech in Brazil, while Twitter censors speech when it comes to India and Turkey. As Ari Paul notes, he's actually being consistent in his quest to use his corporate wealth to alter the political landscape against liberal democracy and towards a dark and despotic future. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Columnist Clarence Page reflects U.S. liberal media's understanding of Haiti with a piece headlined, "Haiti's Tragic History Just Keeps Repeating Itself." The Biden administration, Page writes, shows little appetite to become deeply immersed in perennially troubled Haiti. And it's no secret that many Americans have grown weary of trying to solve too many of the world's problems. The Hill notes that more than 5 million Haitians out of a population of 11 million are at stage 3 and 4 levels of hunger, the fifth stage being famine. The U.S., described as one of the largest donors for Haiti, is reporting difficulties in delivering aid, but bravely plans no change in strategy to address the crisis. A piece in The Plain Dealer suggests why we should care. Haiti's economic, social, and environmental meltdown is sure to reach our shores. So yes, you can learn something about Haiti's current crisis and the U.S. view of it from the news media. What you won't learn about are the roots of the crisis, much less how they can be traced back to the U.S. Chris Bernadelle works with the Black Alliance for Peace, Haiti America's team, and the Haitian grassroots organization Molagas. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Chris Bernadelle.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
The first, if not the only thing, that many U.S. citizens will take away from media coverage about Haiti today is that gang violence is terrorizing the capital, Port-au-Prince. But when Americans think about gangs, their image is generally of poor, young, probably urban people, disaffected, unemployed, who are just grabbing whatever weapons they can and sticking up people on the street for money and for kicks. But that doesn't really properly convey who the gangs right now in Haiti are or where they come from, does it?
No, not at all. And in the history of Haiti, there have been a number of times when armed groups have been involved in the political situation. These armed groups, or paramilitaries, as I like to call them, are funded by the ruling elite of Haitian society, the ruling elite that controls the ports, families like the Bijou family, and they're made up of many of the young men from the poorest areas of the Haitian capital and other parts of Haiti. But many of the members and leadership of these groups are former police, former military. Some of them have military training. So to call them gangs is a mistake. And I would say the proper characterization is paramilitary groups, armed groups, and they're carrying out the interests of the ruling Haitian financial elite, who have controlled Haiti's economy for a long time.
Haiti doesn't manufacture guns, right? So the guns are coming from somewhere else.
Exactly. The guns are coming from the United States. Most are coming through Miami, through these privately owned ports, or ports that are owned by these wealthy families. And they're being disseminated around the poor neighborhoods in order to carry out the political objectives, or try to carry out the political objectives, of different sections of Haiti's ruling elite. So they'll arm one group to attack another group, and they'll, you know, have groups protect certain areas and not go into other areas. But these armed paramilitary groups, for the most part, are carrying out the interests of the ruling elite.
Well, let's talk about the so-called political landscape. The Caribbean Community and Common Market, CARICOM, has put forth a proposal for a transitional government that The Hill, just for one example, says, quote, will be key to efforts to put Haiti on the path to restore security and wrestle control back from the gangs, close quote. Well, you've already complicated the gangs part of that, but what is the response of Haiti advocates to this CARICOM proposal, both what it says and, you know, the way it came about?
This CARICOM proposal is a new face for the same process, the same kind of thing that's been going on. The main issue with Haiti, the main problem in Haiti, are not these armed groups, not these paramilitaries, as is being portrayed. The main problem continues to be what it's been, specifically since the 2004 coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide. So the main problem in Haiti is the international community, the so-called core group, U.S. foreign policy, implementing their will in Haiti and not allowing for Haitian society to develop a government and a civil society that serves their interests and their needs. The constant interventions, starting with the Munista intervention in 2004 that lasted into 2017, which pretty much laid the ground for the crisis we have in Haiti today. That situation removed all what was left of a legitimate Haitian government. We went from a period where we had around 7,000 elected officials to today where we have zero elected officials in power. We've gone from one version of the PHTK to another, first one being delivered to us by Hillary Clinton when she flew into Haiti to ensure that Michel Martelly would be able to pursue the presidency, and then followed by Jovenel Moïse, and then with Ariel Henry. And now that they've forced Ariel Henry to step down in order to implement this transitional council, we're seeing more of the same. These are the same political actors, the same political class that the Haitian people have shown time and time again they do not trust, and they see them as foreign actors, people acting on the behalf of foreign interests.
You know, I know that a lot of listeners don't know the deep history of U.S. intervention in Haiti and international intervention in Haiti. I would ask them to look back to 1791, you know, and George Washington's promise to help the French quell the alarming insurrection of the Negroes, you know, or they can look up the 1915 to 1934 occupation. Or, you know, right up to the 2015 Politico headline calling Bill and Hillary Clinton the king and queen of Haiti. But it is, of course, as you're saying, the 2004 coup, that the role of that can't be overstated. And I guess what I want to say is, like, if you have an illegitimate result, an illegal action, and then that leads to other illegal actions, it doesn't get cleansed along the way because the facts on the ground change. There is no way to understand Haiti's present without understanding its history.
Exactly. And the problem in Haiti is a socioeconomic problem as far as the structure of Haiti's economy, the way that the economy has been artificially propped up to support foreign enterprises and carry out the interests of the core group, primarily France, Canada, the United States. And also, the United States has plans to carry out, using the 2019 Global Fragility Act, the United States has plans to carry out further intervention in Haiti and to further diminish the sovereignty of the Haitian people by implementing more unelected governments, putting people into position without any legitimacy, without any constitutional reasoning, without any constitutional legality. They're putting these people into office. And what's even more outrageous, now that the CARICOM community now is acting in the same way that the core group has been acting in Haiti, they place a requirement on all members of the so-called Transitional Council where they must accept foreign military intervention in order to be a part of this council. So this council is a U.S. idea and is being dictated by the United States and the State Department, as well as CARICOM. And it's not in the interest of the Haitian people. The Haitian people have already rejected many of these actors that are taking seats on this council. A requirement to be in this transitional council, who will be selecting the next leader, de facto leader of Haiti, is to accept this foreign military occupation. This occupation that the U.S. has been trying to arrange, that has been characterized by some as a UN intervention, but it is not a UN intervention. The UN won't be sending in anyone. The U.S. got the Security Council to rubber stamp this Kenyan police force that they're funding to come into the country. And so with the disaster that was the MINUSTAH occupation of 2004 to 2017, where they unleashed cholera into the country and killed over 10,000 people, as many as 30,000 people killed by cholera released into the country by UN peacekeepers, so-called. Now, the U.S., for this intervention that they're planning, it won't even be a UN force officially. So whatever accountability that came along with a UN force being sent to the country, now that won't even be there. Now they were attempting to get a Kenyan force brought into the country, and they've faced some roadblocks with that, political and logistical, I'm sure. And now they are propping up this council to cover up for what they were trying to do under Ariel Henry, which they now see wasn't possible. They're trying to do the same thing now under this council that they're controlling.
With the Global Fragilities Act, that is like, supposedly it's about, countries that are prone to instability or something. I don't know what the language says, without any understanding of what it is that is introducing instability to these places, you know. And this is a new face. But what I hear you saying is it's a new face on an old story, really. It's the same thing.
Exactly right. So-called fragile states, countries prone to instability, conflict, and poverty, are being framed as threats to U.S. security. And the Global Fragility Act is a means for them to more easily send out their resources and institutions from the Defense Department, the State Department, USAID, and the Treasury, so-called international allies and partners, to deal with these situations. So this is just a new form of what they did in 1915 when they invaded the country and had to come up with excuses and reasons to cover up their real motivations. Same thing in 2004 when they did the coup d'etat against Aristide. And now again, we're seeing the same type of intervention into Haitian politics, Haitian society, where the Haitian people, the masses of Haitian people, who for years have been coming out into the streets demanding a transition to a democratic government that represents their interests, the United States and their allies are doing the same thing they've been doing this whole time, implementing a foreign force, implementing foreign control over Haitian government and policy, and the results won't be any different. Now what we're seeing with the so-called gangs, what we call armed groups and paramilitaries, are another way to find a reason to intervene into the country. But it's not just as simple as that, because the dynamics of Haitian society, where you have a tiny ruling class propped up by this international community, but that really runs things from the shadows and plays the role of doing, you know, the dirty business for the U.S., for the imperialist powers of the world, to control and dominate Haitian society, they have in the past and today have found it convenient to fund armed groups, desperate young men in poor neighborhoods, but also, like I mentioned earlier, people who come from the military or the former military, people who come from the police, to enact their interest and will in this situation.
Well, I think folks are going to read media and they're going to hear talk about the transitional committee in government and all of these machinations as being about supporting Haitian sovereignty, you know, and sovereignty is thrown around with reference to officials who have been essentially appointed or installed by the U.S. and international powers. And so every time we talk about sovereignty in Haiti, we're kind of reifying this fiction of what's going on. Yeah, it's deeply misleading.
Yes, that's exactly right. They did this with Ariel Henry, where they propped up Ariel Henry for months and months and months, even though the people of Haiti were demonstrating in the street, coming out against every policy that he ever put out, coming out against the de facto ruler that was imposed on them that had no constitutional authority. And when they reached the end of that rope, when they saw that the situation had gone too far and the armed groups had taken the step to actually keep Henri from re-entering the country, they now have transitioned to a new strategy with this presidential council or this transitional council, which will be more of the same.
Well, let me ask you finally, what do real ways forward look like and what must they include?
Real ways forward must include the Haitian people being able to take control of this transition process. After the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, and even before that, like we spoke about before, with the coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the Haitian government, the Haitian state, has been pretty much destroyed by foreign powers. And the Haitian people have the right to go through their own process, their own domestic process to develop a solution. There are Haitian political organizations like Molagaf who are on the ground working with workers, students, people in the neighborhoods affected by some of this violence. There are other organizations throughout the country. And another thing as well, Haiti is not just Port-au-Prince. There are many other regions where the security situation is not the same, but the political and economic situation due to the situation in the capital, Port-au-Prince, is deteriorating. But not the entire country is in the same situation as Port-au-Prince. But the Haitian people have the will and the right to work through their own process to come up with a transition to get back to a constitutional government and a sovereign democratic state where they can make decisions for themselves. So it's up to us, allies of the Haitian people, to call out the U.S., to see through their different tactics, like what they want to do with the Global Fragility Act, what they've been doing with this transitional council, their plans to bring Kenyan troops into Haiti as a blackface cover for U.S. imperialism. We have to call them out. We have to hold them accountable. And we also have to support organizations in Haiti like Molagaf, and we have to support the Haitian people in general to allow them the space to develop a transition, to develop a solution to these problems. And they can do it. The United States, the foreign powers, the core group will continue to intervene and try to control the process. But as we've seen, things have gotten out of hand. They can't predict what's going to happen next, and they can't control the situation. So they're trying to look for new versions of the same solution they've always proposed to the situation, which is them dominating. So now the Haitian people have an opportunity to develop their own processes, their own solutions, and it's going to be up to them. All we can do is keep the U.S. government out of it and try our best to keep the U.S. government from overthrowing whatever democratic, sovereign form of Haitian government that can come out of that process.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Chris Bernadel from the Black Alliance for Peace, Haiti America's team, as well as Molagas, a Haitian grassroots organization. You can find information about what we're talking about online at blackallianceforpeace.com. Chris Bernadel, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
You're welcome.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's newsletter extra or to show support for Counterspin and FAIR if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the long-fought effort to get legal acknowledgement of the abuses of Iraqi detainees during the Iraq War is coming to a federal court in Virginia with Al-Shamari versus CACI, or CACI. Since the case was first filed in 2008, military contractor CACI has pushed some 20 times to have it dismissed. Time magazine unwittingly told the tale with their recent headline, Abu Ghraib military contractor trial set to start 20 years after shocking images of abuse. See, that's the thing. People had been reporting the horrific treatment of Iraqi detainees at the Baghdad area prison and elsewhere, but it was only when those photos were released, photos the Defense Department tried hard to suppress, that it was so undeniable it had to be acknowledged. We got a reading on the case last year from Bahir Azmi, legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Also on the show, historians tell us that the Cold War is over, but the framing persists in news media that love a simple good guy versus bad guy story, even as who the good and the bad guys are shifts over time. Telling history through actual human beings makes it harder to come up with slam dunk answers, but can raise questions that are ultimately more useful for those seeking a peaceful planet. A new book provides a sort of case study on that. It's about Ted Hall, who, as a young man, shared nuclear secrets from Los Alamos with the then Soviet Union. Veteran investigative journalist Dave Lindorf has reported for numerous outlets. He's author of Marketplace Medicine and This Can't Be Happening, among other books. We talked with him about his latest, Spy for No Country, the story of Ted Hall, the teenage atomic spy who may have saved the world, which is out now from Prometheus Books. That's coming up this week on Counterspin. The New York Times ran a poignant obituary last year for Ian Fishback, a former Army major who became an anti-torture whistleblower. Fishback spoke up about prisoner abuse in 2004, and when his concerns were ignored in the military, he brought them to the wider world, in the wake of revelations about abuses against Iraqi men at the Baghdad area prison Abu Ghraib. The obituary suggests compassion for Fishback and for the victims of U.S. military actions that he tried so hard to spotlight. But when a judge said that one case calling the perpetrators to account would go forward, the Times didn't report on it. Though that month they did feature a piece about why George W. Bush, quote, doesn't second-guess himself on Iraq, close quote. And that's the spotty story of big media coverage of the documented horrific abuses at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere carried out by U.S. military and hired contractors. Earnest concern sometimes, but not the sort of sustained, systemic investigation that would prevent their recurrence. The civil trial against U.S. defense contractor CACI, or CACI, began this week. It's one of the last vestiges of efforts to call major actors to account for what happened at Abu Ghraib. And media are covering it. CNN notes that two decades after revelations of torture, the proceeding is the first time Abu Ghraib survivors are able to bring their story to a U.S. jury. CACI's lawyers, unsurprisingly, lay all of the fault on what one literally called, quote, a handful of bad apples, close quote. There were MPs, said John O'Connor, quote, who were sadistic, who did it on their own and without any encouragement, close quote. We'll see if news media have the appetite to interrogate that dismissal, or if, like high-level Bush White House officials, they will condemn it heartily and then move on. Al-Shamari versus CACI was brought on behalf of three Iraqis by the Center for Constitutional Rights. Counterspin spoke with CCR's legal director, Bahar Azmi, last August.
This is actually the third of three cases we brought on behalf of Iraqi victims of torture by the U.S. government and private military contractors in Iraq and Abu Ghraib. One case was thrown out by the D.C. Federal Court of Appeals, led by Kavanaugh with a dissent from then-Judge Garland. A second case on behalf of 71 individuals brought against a translation company, L3 Services, that settled favorably. And this, the third, is brought on behalf of three remaining plaintiffs, three victims of torture at the so-called hard site at Abu Ghraib, where all of the depictions of torture we have seen were revealed. And it's very challenging to sue the U.S. military for torture, but U.S. generals did an investigation of the torture at Abu Ghraib and identified that private military contractors, including CACI, had a preeminent role. CACI sent a number of untrained individuals to serve as interrogators under a very profitable $35 million contract. And as the report and the evidence revealed, in the command vacuum that occurred at Abu Ghraib, it was CACI interrogators who were telling military police, including people you might recognize if you're old enough, Lindsey England, Ivan Frederick and Charles Grainer, to, quote, soften up detainees via torture for its later interrogation by CACI. So this seeks accountability against the private military contractor for actions that U.S. service members spent considerable time in a military brig for. And it seeks to close that accountability gap and hold this profit-making enterprise accountable for its clear role in contributing to the torture and abuse of our plaintiffs.
Well, I don't know if it matters to say at this point that prisoners in Abu Ghraib were not criminals. These were not people who were charged and convicted, but maybe that's worth mentioning here.
Correct. And there are clear duties under the laws of war to respect their not engage in war crimes or what is called cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And notably, the judge in this case has found sufficient evidence that CACI was a direct conspirator, aided and abetted the actual torture of our clients. So enough evidence that a jury could find them liable. And that's what we're hoping will be the next step in front of a United States jury.
Well, CACI says, as I understand it, that since the United States would have immunity in this case, well, then we were working for them, so we also have immunity. What do you have to say? I mean, I remember an interview with deeply missed CCR President Michael Ratner explaining in 2004 that this idea that torture isn't torture came in with U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and kind of things went south at that point. But that's CACI's line, that since we're acting as the government, we therefore have immunity against these charges?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The subtext of this is a really sort of disturbing pattern among all private military contractors, which I think is seeking precisely this. Even though they act for profit, have no sovereign responsibilities, are in no way politically accountable, democratically accountable, they want to assume the same benefit as the government, as if CACI was a sovereign entity rather than a profit-making entity. That seems like a terrifying notion for me. And the subtext is, I think, ultimately from a range of private military contractors to get the law in the place to fulfill a kind of Eric Princean vision where private military contractors can go into war spaces and enjoy the same immunity as the United States government. And so far, the courts have plainly resisted that. You're not allowed to assume the immunity of the United States government if you yourself have broken the law, even as a contractor. And the courts have rejected Kaki's argument, building on what John Yoo and Dick Cheney have said, just these are not legal questions. They're political questions. They're out of the jurisdiction of the courts, what we choose to do with prisoners during wartime. But the court flatly rejected that and said they can be accountable for torture, even if they were participating with the military.
All right, then. Well, for many people, Abu Ghraib is a series of horrific photographs, and maybe the government's efforts to suppress them, the media's release of them, and then a kind of collective gasp, you know, shocking the conscience, we heard. But then we got the sense, vaguely speaking, that since we've had our conscience shocked, we've addressed it. And so let's all move on from that difficult time. But if no real deep going up to the top accountability happens, aren't we just kind of setting ourselves up for the next, oh my gosh, that's terrible, that's carried out in our name?
Well, you know, I really quite agree. And I've been, you know, as someone who's been heavily involved and early involved in the responses to the human rights crisis created by the Bush administration and the lawlessness there, I draw a connection between the kind of soft authoritarianism of the Bush administration and the sanctioned lawlessness and demand for impunity and subverting U.S. institutions and constraints on executive power to the kind of hard authoritarianism that the Trump administration embraced. I mean, should we really be surprised by the Muslim ban that Trump escalated, given what the Bush administration tried and largely got away with? Should we be surprised with lawyers like John Yoo and in the torture context and John Eastman in the insurrection context trying to sanction or legitimize under law subverting American institutions? I think precisely the problem with not holding high-level officials to account is these abuses get replicated and indeed escalated.
Well, we're going to end on that important note. We've been speaking with Bahar Azmi, legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can track their work, including on this case, which is not closed, but is going forward at ccrjustice.org. Bahar Azmi, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
That was CCR legal director Bahar Azmi speaking with us in August 2023. The success of the movie Oppenheimer showed that there is interest in the human beings involved in the Manhattan Project, the choices, beliefs, situational ethics, if you will, of those involved in the World War II program to develop the atomic bomb. Another key figure, likewise reflective of the human complexities involved in creating and deploying this devastating technology, has remained relatively unknown until now. Ted Hall was just 18 years old when he was recruited to Los Alamos, where he became a key scientist behind the bombs known as Little Man and Fat Boy, and eventually a spy, delivering nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. His story was the subject of the 2022 documentary A Compassionate Spy by acclaimed Hoop Dreams director Steve James. Our guest was a co-producer of that film and is author of a new book, Spy for No Country: The Story of Ted Hall, the Teenage Atomic Spy Who May Have Saved the World, from Prometheus Books. Veteran investigative journalist Dave Lindorf has reported for numerous outlets and is author of Marketplace Medicine and This Can't Be Happening, among other titles. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dave Lindorf.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we can't presume listeners who knew who Robert Oppenheimer was even before the movie have even heard the name Ted Hall before. So, in bold strokes, What did he do, and when or in what context?
Well, Ted Hall is really fascinating because he was so young. He's been overlooked, I think, by historians even of that era of the atomic development of atomic energy. And part of the reason, too, is that he was never prosecuted, even though in 1950 he was one of the first people identified as an atomic spy at Los Alamos, with the final decryption starting to happen of the Soviet spy cables that the precursor to the NSA had been collecting from Soviet consulates. Yet, despite Hoover getting that information in 1950 and interrogating him and his Harvard roommate Currier for 3 hours, the case went nowhere, and the book explains why.
Folks may not remember, or it might be a little confuddled, the Soviet Union was an ally during World War II.
That's a very important point to make that people have to realize as they learn about this guy.
Yeah, so as much as we might want to ascribe motivation, especially after the fact, we can never see inside another person's head. But what is the sense of what Hall thought he was doing? He wasn't, for instance, a communist himself.
No, he was not a communist when he was a spy. He did briefly join the party. He and his wife that he married after the war, they both became party members for a few months because, as they said, it was the only organization they felt that was combating the segregation in the U.S. and that was defending workers' right to organize.
When we say, what did Ted Hall do? What did he do, and why do we think he did it?
Well, he was so smart, incredibly brilliant, and it was recognized when he got there. He was assigned to be working on the development of the implosion system for the plutonium bomb, which was a very complicated bomb. The uranium bomb was very simple, but you just had to refine enough U-235, which is a minute portion of uranium ore, in order for it to work. But with plutonium, it was so unstable that it was very hard to work with in large quantities. So he was working on that project. He understood the entire details of the plutonium bomb, and he realized that the Germany was not going to get the bomb. It was being bombed to smithereens in 1944 when he was hired, and that the U.S. was going to come out of the war with a monopoly on the bomb, which he thought would be a catastrophe for the world, I think correctly. So he decided the only thing to do was to give the Soviets the bomb so that there would be two countries with the bomb that would prevent each of them from using it.
Well, I've heard it said that, you know, put simply, Oppenheimer thought he could somehow get nuclear weaponry eliminated or under international control. But as you say, Hall thought that mutually assured destruction would keep this technology from being used. Is that?
Yeah.
Well, I appreciated a review of the film, A Compassionate Spy, in Decider that said, is Ted Hall a hero or a traitor? Note to everyone everywhere, you don't need to answer that question. In other words, agreeing with him and his actions isn't necessary. It's really more about the complexity of truth, that questions exist for which there are no satisfying answers. But I think it's difficult for folks to put themselves back in the head of a person making that choice at that time.
Well, you have to know what people were thinking at that time. At that time, for example, there was a dinner hosted by the British scientists who'd been brought over at a late period. I guess they came in early 1944 from England to help speed up the development of the bomb. And there was a dinner that they hosted, and they had invited General Leslie Groves, the head of the whole Manhattan Project. And yeah, over dessert, people were starting to say, this happened in the spring of 1944, that they shouldn't really build the bomb because the Germans weren't going to get the bomb. And why were they developing it? And Groves said, well, as you know, the bomb was not really to target Germany. It was to help control the Soviet Union. And that went around the camp because, you know, that Los Alamos had these rules that Oppenheimer insisted on that there was absolute openness within the walls of the camp, heavily guarded walls of the camp, but outside there was no discussion about what they were doing. It was all top secret. Nobody knew what was happening inside that fence. What they didn't know was that there were spies within it, and one of them was Ted Hall. He certainly heard the scuttlebutt, you know, that the Russians were the real target. And that was very disturbing to him and to many of the scientists who felt that the Soviets were doing most of the dying and most of the fighting against the Germans at that time, and that they were our ally.
Well, you touched on it, but let me just ask you directly, why wasn't Ted Hall prosecuted? Why wasn't he treated the way that Oppenheimer was?
It's an amazing story. It turns out that Ted's older brother, 11 years older than him, who had taken charge of his early education and encouraged him to go to Harvard when he was 18, and this brother, Ed Hall, actually became the top rocket scientist for the Air Force and he developed the engine for the Atlas, the engine for the Titan, the engine for the Thor missile, and he invented the whole concept of ICBM with solid fuel, the Minuteman. That was his creation and his idea of having hundreds of them in silos as a prevention of nuclear attack on the U.S. was sold by him to the defense secretary at the time in the 50s and then to Eisenhower. So he was so important to the Air Force. I got his FBI file after they first told me there wasn't one, got over 100 pages, that Hoover was hoping that he was going to catch him as a spy, Ed, you know, Hall as a spy, as well as Ted Hall, and the Air Force shut him down. They basically refused to let him question Ed about his own history, just whether he knew anything about his brother, and he denied it. And then by late 1951, Ted was taken off of the security index, and they stopped monitoring his mail and his phones. Nobody ever knew that, why he didn't get investigated. And it's just astonishing. Because, Janine, the most important thing about this story, and it's another thing that Americans don't know, as soon as the war ended, the U.S. started in the Manhattan Project, and then later the Atomic Energy Commission, working feverishly to figure out a way to mass-produce atomic bombs. And by 1948, they were producing them at 100 a month. And why were they doing that when they thought that there'd been no spies in the project and that the Soviet Union would not get an atomic bomb for at least 8 or 10 years after this one? You know, the two bombs were invented by the U.S. and tested on the Japanese. So the reason was they were preparing to attack the Soviet Union. There was even a day they estimated in 1954 that they were calling a day when it would be impossible to attack the Soviet Union preemptively because they'd have the bomb by then and be able to slip one into a harbor in the U.S. As retaliation. And that all fell apart when the Soviets detonated a carbon copy of the bomb that Ted was working on in 1949.
Well, in media, Dave, we know that U.S.-Russia relations are super simplistically presented. It's like Rock'em Sock'em Robots, you know, or King Kong versus Godzilla. And the fact that there are human beings making choices with the information that they have at the time and their thoughts about how what they're doing might be used, it's both difficult to think about and it's easy to obscure. And so some folks now are rattling the nuclear saber, if only rhetorically, again. And what do you think is the value of lifting up Ted Hall's story right now?
Well, first of all, he proved to be right. He did what Oppenheimer wouldn't do by, you know, actually sharing the secrets and making it possible for there to be two countries with the bomb. And the result was that we have not seen an atomic bomb used since Nagasaki. We're on the 79 years and counting since those two bombs were dropped, and none has been used because of, you know, multiple nations having the bomb. You just can't do it. And now whether that'll hold, it's always been pretty precarious, but it's the best that they've come up with is just having mutual assured destruction. It's not a good system, but, you know, it's here. I personally think that it's bluster still, because all the game planning, when they look at what happens if we use an atomic bomb or we reply with an atomic bomb when one is used, it always escalates within, you know, hours or days into a full-scale global strategic nuclear bombing and destruction of the Earth.
Right. Well, let me ask you finally, from a journalism or media perspective, some reviewers of the film in particular have said essentially humanizing Ted Hall at all, and the film talks a lot with his wife, Joan, humanizing him is bias, you know, because he was a traitor, the end. And then other people say, well, we don't really need Wikipedia-style history. We don't need news from nowhere. That it's a disservice to just present sort of big good versus big evil, and that starting from a human perspective helps us locate ourselves within this broad sweep of events that once they're done can seem inevitable. And I don't imagine that you would have been attracted to a story that was kind of cut-paste print. You know, the complexity, was that part of the draw for you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, think about what he did. At the one hand, he thought that the bomb was a horrible, horrible thing. At the other, he was working feverishly trying to help them get it, because when he was hired, he thought it was important to get it before the Germans did. And then when he found that wasn't the case, he was still working on it because he knew that it was going to be built with him or without him. And yet, that meant he was contributing to when it was finally used, because he wanted to be able to give all the information to the Russians. He knew that there were going to be bombs used if that didn't happen. And I think that's correct, that it must have been torture for him to know that he had helped create what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Yet he felt it was the right thing that he had done. So it was very complicated.
All right, then. Well, we'll leave it there for now. We've been speaking with Dave Lindorf. The new book, Spy for No Country, is out from Prometheus Books. Thank you so much, Dave Lindorf, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. And thanks for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
To an experiment with time on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I finally did it, folks. I finally got all four Angel and Heavy Syrup albums, the 1990s all-female Japanese psych rock legends. Gonna feature a lot of their music on tonight's show. Uranium Club of Minnesota also has a brand new album out that is incredible. Gonna drop a couple tracks off of that one too. Let's get right into it. This is Breath of Life from Angel and Heavy Syrup's third album, released in 1995.